يوسف جلالي بتهران.
روباشافيت غازا.
جيروم هيوز بروسلز.
سعيد بورزا لندن.
راشا ساغلام اسطنبول.
سعيد امين علمي كابول.
شاهان بات انديان ادمنستريد كشمير.
With reporters.
I'm Jeremy Lofredo for The Gray Zone in Israel, where last...
Jeremy Lofredo is an investigative journalist with The Gray Zone website who was arbitrarily detained days after his video exposed damage incurred by Iran's operation to Israeli military facilities, including Nevatim Air Base in the Negev Desert.
I drove 70 miles south to the highly sensitive Air Force installation, aiming to document the underreported and potentially embarrassing destruction.
Lofredo also traveled to Tel Aviv for his reporting, described what he saw in the streets near the Israel spy agency Mossad's headquarters after it was hit by Iranian ballistic missiles.
Using visual clues from footage circulating online, I set out to locate where the missile may have landed. I saw a heavily damaged SUV, its windshield shattered, debris and concrete caked into the vehicle. Further down, the scene unfolded. Destroyed vehicles, torn up asphalt, and a massive crater, roughly 30 feet wide, recently filled in with dirt. This information is missing from all Israeli media reports due to the fact it's been officially censored.
Lofredo says the charges against him included providing information to the enemy during wartime, which, if convicted, carries a minimum 25-year prison sentence and a maximum death sentence. He explained how he was detained and treated in the Israeli captivity.
On the afternoon of October the 8th, just days after my report on the Iranian missile strike was published, I was stopped outside a military checkpoint near Nablus in the northern West Bank. They tightly wrapped a cloth around my head as a blindfold, shackled my legs, handcuffed my wrists, and walked me into the back of a military truck. In custody, I was treated not like a journalist but as an enemy, a distinction that, for Israel, seemed irrelevant. I was held in solitary confinement, deprived of adequate food and water.
In Lofredo's idea, the courage threshold for investigative journalists in the occupied Palestinian territories has risen to an extreme level, and reporting truth means being willing to risk imprisonment or death. However, Lofredo says restrictions have proven ineffective in containing certain information, as Israelis can still access foreign publications. He says Israel has escalated its high-handed tactics, relying on threats of violence, incarceration, and even death to maintain its censorship regime. On October 20th, Lofredo, after spending days in solitary confinement, was informally deported to the U.S. Formal deportation would have required convicting him on terror charges. The journalist's case is still open, and what it seems as a deterrent to ensure if he returned, Lofredo would face detention again. But Lofredo says he will continue reporting on Palestine from outside the occupied territories.
South Africa's own experience in confronting a violent oppressor shows that the people are the backbone of any resistance. Veteran anti-apartheid military commander and former intelligence minister Ronnie Castrels says he personally communicated this message to Palestinian resistance leaders in Syria and the Gaza Strip. Commemorating the martyrdom of Hamas resistance movement leaders Ismail Haniya and Yahya Sinwar and Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, Castrels and other figures reflected on the way forward to hold Israel to account.
The people in struggle is your power. The armed struggle reinforces the overall struggle. The underground network assists the resistance. We've seen this. And then number four is international solidarity. Very powerful.
So despite the assassination of senior leaders of the resistance, which was also witnessed during the South African freedom struggle, where exiled activists were assassinated through letter bombs, the resistance will go on.
Martyrdom in itself and the loss of our leaders, it's plays such a pivotal role. So even if you're a person of no faith, but when your leader is killed in a most brutal fashion, assassinated, you actually take courage from that, and in fact, it speeds the downfall of the tyrant.
While South Africa has been commended for charging Israel with genocide at the International Court of Justice, people have urged it to take more decisive actions, such as through sanctions. Those who masterminded South Africa's struggle against apartheid say the government has so far failed to properly address the issue.
When South Africa takes action, the world really takes note, and the moral voice and strength of South Africa.
Despite the political manoeuvres on the front lines, the message hasn't changed. Recent weeks have witnessed a surge of intense and deadly anti-Israeli operations, proving that the assassination of top leaders such as Said Hassan Nasrallah, Yahya Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh will not diminish the strength of the resistance. Rather, these Israeli crimes will only intensify the determination of the resistance to deal even heavier blows on the occupying regime. Hassan Sirieb, Cape Town.
Immigration is a top issue in next week's election in the United States, as the Border Patrol has documented nearly 11 million encounters during the administration of Joe Biden, as compared with just over 3 million during the era of Donald Trump. That's caused major changes and even crises in many small towns and big cities in the U.S., and a worsening of the refugee crisis in Latin America. The seven Latin American countries which have lost the greatest percentage of their population to the U.S., Nicaragua, Cuba, Honduras, Haiti, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Venezuela, have all been recent victims of American-led coups and sanctions.
I mean, the main thing I always say about Latin America, about the Middle East, about all these areas, if you don't want refugees coming into your nation, don't destabilize these nations. Don't go around bombing these nations. Don't go around supporting fascist leaders in these nations or leaders that don't listen to the people.
What's more, the Biden administration has expanded welcome efforts targeting immigrants from leftist-inspired countries like Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba.
Cubans they can just put one foot in the United States and they're automatically Americans. They get all kinds of benefits. They get housing and things. They get shipped to South Florida. They want to create turmoil in Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. They want to have it as difficult as people can to survive. I mean, why can't Cubans send money, remittances, back to Cuba? That's just inhuman.
The recent increase follows basic capitalist economics. In a period of record price increases, a mass influx of workers, representing new labor competition, will cause the existing workforce to reduce their demands for higher wages to keep up with the price increases. Promoting a key plank of fascist ideology, Trump has promised the largest mass deportation scheme in U.S. history, even as it seems like empty campaign bluster.
Mass deportation would encounter bureaucratic opposition at every level of government and massive resistance at the street level. The army is legally barred from participating in domestic law enforcement, and even a Republican sweep of Congress might have trouble in changing that 150-year-old law.
I think it would be horrible, and I think that it wouldn't be just undocumented immigrants who would be deported. I think that a lot of brown-skinned people would be swept up, and I think it would create a real racist hysteria in the country. Hopefully, other people would rise up and protest and help defend them, because it would be just a real travesty.
From the number of new courts to the number of new lawyers to the number of new police dedicated to immigration, deporting even a million undocumented immigrants a year would require an unprecedented financial and bureaucratic expansion of the state, which is something the typical Republican totally opposes. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
The Yemeni army has escalated its military actions against the Israeli regime, hitting targets from both land and sea. In recent operations, three Israeli-linked ships attempting to cross the strategic Bab el-Mandeb Strait were attacked at sea by various Yemeni armament. Less than 16 hours later, Yemeni armed forces launched three drones striking targets in the industrial zone of Ashkelon in southern occupied Palestine.
No doubt that continuous military operations against Israel at sea and the missile attack inside Israel are an indication we are in a critical phase where the army is trying to side and is starving the people in Gaza.
These recent attacks come as Israel suffers heavy losses in southern Lebanon and Gaza at the hands of resistance fighters. To add to the resistance military power, Yemen's navy also unveiled a new torpedo designed to devastate Israeli ships. The torpedo is engineered to deliver devastating damage to the lower hull of vessels, posing a serious threat to Israel's maritime assets.
The torpedoes are a more powerful weapon, which means any vessel hit by these torpedoes will surely sink. This is indeed a show of strength. It is also an indication of our naval military advancement that is ready to discipline the U.S. or any nation attempting to violate the Yemeni sovereignty.
Although Yemen's geographic location prevents its forces from directly engaging Israel, the Yemeni army has strategically leveraged its position to weaken Israel militarily and economically from afar. The Yemeni army has stepped up its attacks against Israeli targets by launching more missiles and drones. These military operations are taking a toll against the Israeli regime and its economy as they call on the U.S. to help address those losses. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
The Islamic Movement and Jordanian activists organize a pro-Palestinian march under the banner Save Resilient Jabalia in Amman. They expressed the strong support for Palestinians in northern Gaza, particularly in Jabalia. Participants condemned the severe humanitarian conditions there, citing continuous attacks, starvation tactics, and a total blockade on food and medical supplies.
Mass atrocities continue in Jabalia for the 24th consecutive day. The occupying forces appear intent on forced displacement, which, if unchallenged, could also include Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. We must firmly reject all forms of forced displacement.
We gather here today to support Gaza, acknowledging that no action we take, whether now, in the future, or even in the past, can be compared to the sacrifices made by the Palestinians there. We hope for a swift end to the war. May God have mercy on all the martyrs.
Participants criticized the international community's inaction in the face of Israeli crimes, expressing solidarity with displaced people in Jabalia refugee camp, who are now under siege. They also reaffirmed their commitment to supporting the resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Today, we stand together to boost the spirit of our brothers in Gaza, who are making sacrifices for a noble cause. I want to emphasize that even if the leaders of the resistance are martyred, many will rise to take their place.
We are here to support our brothers in Jabalia, Gaza, and Palestine as they resist the aggressors. We ask God to grant them strength and success in their struggle.
Israel continues to displace Palestinians amid its ongoing military campaign in northern Gaza, applying deadly measures against approximately 400,000 individuals in the region, while enforcing a strict blockade that prevents the entry of food and medical supplies.
The Islamic movement in Jordan has called for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip and demanded Amman sever its ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
More than a year into Israel's genocidal war in Gaza has led to the death and injury of hundreds of thousands of people in the besieged territory. The rest left have been displaced and are fighting for very daily existence with the bare minimum in their hands. Trapped in tents and uninhabitable shelters, winter will harm thousands of displaced families struggling for any means of life amid the unfathomable carnage and the incessant Israeli horror inflicted upon them. And as starvation hits back, their lives will only become more hellish.
Our tents are uninhabitable. The summer heat has caused the tent's nylon components to tear. We've appealed to the organizations to assist with providing rainflies to keep the water from coming inside the tent, but we've yet to hear back. A lot of problems plague us here in the Shu'ab displacement camp. We've no food, blankets, rainflies, or covers. Our kids don't get medicine or even clothes. We flood Al-Shujaya neighborhood without anything.
Since our tent is merely made of ripped pieces, we are without covers, blankets, and rain flies. Here we have nothing. There is no food, medication, or clothes. At night, our little brother shivers from the cold. We only have one blanket. We don't have anything to cover ourselves with. We can't even fit in our tiny tent.
Winter clothes have been banned from entering the strip, adding to people suffering in the face of extreme adversity. And for people who remain without shelter on the streets, the trauma they're facing will be unmatched.
The displaced people in Gaza have experienced terrible misery in every aspect of their lives as a result of Israel's genocidal war on the Strip. They will now face additional traumas when winter approaches, depriving them of every means of survival and leaving them shivering with fear and cold. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
As in previous years, people from Pakistan and Kashmir took to the streets on October 27 to mark Black Day. Pakistan regards this day as the anniversary of India's defiance of British partition plan in 1947, which led to India's control over the Jammu and Kashmir regions. The day was marked with rallies, protests, and seminars to express solidarity with the Kashmiri people and their continued struggle for self-determination under Indian control.
We will continue to raise voice for the oppressed people of Kashmir who are facing atrocities by Indian forces in Jammu and Kashmir regions. We want justice from the international community for their right of self-determination.
We condemn Indian illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir region. Kashmiris have been struggling for their right to self-determination for the past 77 years. Thousands of Kashmiris, men, women, and children have been brutally killed by Indian occupied forces in recent years, and the international community is just a silent observer.
Kashmir, a predominantly Muslim Himalayan region, remains a point of division between India and Pakistan, both holding parts of it but claiming the region in full. The Kashmir conflict has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed neighbors since their separation in 1947. The observance of Kashmir Solidarity Day allows not only the people of Pakistan, but also its government to voice their support for the Kashmir Liberation Movement.
Pakistan will continue to extend political, diplomatic, and moral support to our Kashmiri brothers and sisters for the just and peaceful settlement of the Jammu and Kashmir dispute in accordance with the UN Security Council resolutions.
Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari and the Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif urged the international community to push India to end human rights abuses in Jammu and Kashmir regions and to implement UN Security Council resolutions.
In the face of global diplomatic pressure, Pakistan's stance remains unwavering as it advocates for a resolution that aligns with the Kashmiri people's aspirations and their right to self-determination. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of this speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a thousand of veterans and active members in the sacred defense and the resistance field. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 25, 2024. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, Lord of the worlds, and may peace and greetings be upon our Master and our Prophet, Abul Ghassim al-Mustafa al-Muhammad, and upon his untainted, pure, chosen progeny, particularly the remnant of God, Imam As, on earth. Welcome, dear brothers and sisters. The topics raised by the brothers and sisters were very good. Some of them were related to this group pertaining to war memories and the sacred defense matters, which those esteemed individuals should follow up on. Some issues are related to government agencies. The brothers in my office should follow up on the points that have been mentioned so that these matters can be investigated. That which is practical and useful will, God willing, be carried out.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The reason veterans are especially honored during Sacred Defense Week is due to the value of being a veteran and a pioneer in significant events. Take the lead toward forgiveness from the Lord. This is mentioned in the Holy Quran, Surah 57, Ayah 21. Taking the lead and stepping into uncharted territories is valuable. Of course, Sacred Defense Week belongs to all the fighters, mujahideen, martyrs, their families, and such people. However, the veterans and those who entered the field earlier, quicker, and with greater commitment have a higher value. Whether a veteran is a commander, an ordinary soldier, a doctor, a rescue worker, a jihadi worker, or someone who is supporting in the rear, all of these people are deserving of this special type of praise and respect. We saw various types of these veterans during the early days of the Sacred Defense, and we saw the role they played and their contributions. Good topics for us to discuss for our audience today regarding the Sacred Defense primarily revolve around two issues. Of course, there is a third issue as well, but I won't have time to talk about that today. One of these two fundamental topics is the reason for the 8-year war. Our younger generation, who weren't around at the time of the war or the revolution, need to know why the Islamic Republic entered into a battle that lasted 8 years. 8 years isn't a short period of time. During that time, all the country's resources and facilities were dedicated to defending the country. What was the reason for our entry into the war? We need to know this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Guided me from all the ways
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Mirati has criticized Israel's expansion of attacks on his country. He said Israel's repeated threats to the population to evacuate entire cities and villages and its renewed targeting of Beirut and its suburbs indicate the Israeli enemy's rejection of all efforts to secure a ceasefire. The resumption of Israeli attacks on Lebanon's capital happened as U.S. envoys were in Israel on Thursday for talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The meeting reportedly ended without any breakthrough. Meanwhile, many analysts believe that the conditions that the Israeli regime has set for a ceasefire with Lebanon are not realistic. Israel is demanding the freedom to operate even after a ceasefire and the freedom to target what it sees as threats and violations by Hezbollah. According to Hezbollah, this condition amounts to a surrender, and it's something the resistance group will never accept. That and more will be discussed on Spotlight. Here are our guests. Professor of Political Science at Beer Zayt University, Saad Nim, joining us from Ramallah. And also we have activist and political analyst Batul Sobeti joining us from the British capital, London.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr in Ramallah. Yesterday, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said negotiations have made progress toward a deal that would bring a ceasefire in Lebanon. Now, that comment is questionable in itself, as the meeting reportedly ended without any breakthrough. But then Israel follows that up with a massive and deadly aggression against Lebanon, bombing many areas in the capital, Beirut. These actions are nothing new, from the warmongers in Tel Aviv to prevent truce agreements.
Good evening to you and to your guest from London and all your viewers. Well, I think, yes, Blinken was absolutely right. There was a progress, but this progress in the negotiation, it was between Israel and the United States. It had nothing to do with Lebanon or Hezbollah. Nobody consulted them. Nobody talked to them anyway. And it is Hochstein who came to Tel Aviv. He sat with Netanyahu, and they have talks. And Netanyahu gave him his conditions to end the war. And he left immediately back to Washington. He didn't even go to Lebanon. He didn't discuss that with Lebanon. And so the negotiations was between Israel and America. And they agreed. They agreed that all these conditions that the Israelis are adding to the resolution 1701 is absolutely right. And they, you know, both of them agreed that it is a good progress, you know, which allowed Israel to continue their war against Lebanon, while Hezbollah should stop all kind of atrocities or all kind of attacks on Israel at the same time. And Israel have the right, even after the full ceasefire, to continue to go into the Lebanese air and also target it whoever they wanted, and also to monitor the airport and to monitor also the land crossings or land borders with Syria. And these are very nice conditions, I think, by the Israelis and the Americans. And I believe that the Israeli now, they want to say that we are the winners. We are now won this war. And consequently, we put our own conditions. But in reality, they are, you know, having lots of troubles in Lebanon now. And let them continue. Let them continue to have all these rockets coming and all these drones, as well as they can't even go few meters into Lebanon on the borders between Lebanon and occupied Palestine.
Bassel Soubaiti in London. The Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati had expressed hope that an agreement would be signed within days. Following the recent deadly Israeli airstrikes, Mirati said the expansion of the attacks on Lebanon and most notably Beirut suburbs and the regime's repeated threats to the population to evacuate entire cities and villages indicates Israel's rejection of efforts to secure a ceasefire. Is that what the Israelis are doing again?
Right, absolutely. America, this talk about ceasefire is absolute nonsense. It's been repeated for a whole year. America doesn't intend for a ceasefire now. We're a few days away from the American election date. America is in the corner when it comes to this issue and has no time, so it's all just propaganda talks. So we know America's not serious. We know that it has given Israel the free hand to do what it wants. The aggression, effectively, into Lebanon has been greenlit by America. Until now, the official Lebanese position has been the implementation of the UN resolution 1701 that the resistance in Lebanon has also agreed to. And that stipulates that Israel should not transgress on Lebanese sovereignty, whether that's through air or through sea. We've seen Nabih Berri, who is negotiating on that basis of the removal of the Israeli occupation entity from Lebanese territory. But we see that America, as the guest alluded to, through its negotiator, Hochstein, are saying that they want additions to this resolution that effectively break it through breaking Lebanese sovereignty and granting Israel the upper hand and giving it extra powers, you know, pushing the resistance, for example, behind the Litani River, giving extra authority to UNIFIL and the occupation forces to search areas relating to weapons depots, etc. America right now, the way we're seeing it is America's dealing with the resistance as a dead corpse that they want to bury. And they want to inherit the forces on the ground as though the resistance is already defeated. But the reality is that still stands, and that is that Israel cannot gain a single village. Israel is unable to enter effectively on the ground and consolidate its control in the Lebanese villages. The reality is that over 200 rockets per day continue to go into the heart of the Israeli occupation entity. The reality is that this month has been the most costly for the Israeli occupation entity since last year, October. So there is no ground for such talks. It's laughable. The military, what the military can't do, the political front cannot do. They want the resistance to basically take through politics what it cannot achieve through force, and that's effectively not going to happen.
Professor Nim, many analysts believe that the conditions that Israel has set for a ceasefire with Lebanon are not realistic. Israel is demanding the freedom to operate even after a ceasefire and the freedom to target what it sees as threats and violations by Hezbollah. As we mentioned in the intro, Hezbollah said that these conditions are basically a way of surrendering, and it's something that they would never accept. Unpack that for us. Most notably, the stance of the resistance that has shown it will not budge in the face of the Israeli demands.
Yeah, well, let me just refer to the last speech of Naim Qasem, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. And he said quite clear, we agreed to the 1701 and nothing else. And if there is a ceasefire, it will be according to our conditions, the resistant conditions, meaning Israel is, you know, adding all these kind of conditions. And usually in such cases, the winners who are usually the one, or the victorious who are the one who could put their terms and conditions. And the question is, did Israel win this war so far? Are they really, you know, as Batul just said, are they entering Lebanon, you know, to make sure that they are, you know, saying that, okay, we'll pull out of Lebanon, but we need, you know, more conditions. You didn't achieve anything apart from the only thing that they can do usually, which is, you know, killing people by the air force. This is the only thing they have in their hands, the superiority of the air, and they go and bombard it here and there and killing people and civilians, and now they are out even of targets. They started, you know, targeting now in Lebanon, you know, the ambulances, hospitals, and also a bank, you know. This is really ridiculous. And the Israeli think that these are kind of, you know, victories. They are not, but they know it. They know it, that they are not victorious, but they want to show that they are victorious and put their terms. But in reality, Hezbollah is going to continue, and then the Israeli have to come to their terms and pull back from the south of Lebanon and stop the war, even according to the, finally, according to the resolution 1701. And they can't do much better than that.
Ms. Sawaiti, Israel is bombing hospitals, clinics, and residential areas in Lebanon, just like it did in Gaza. Many are seeing the aggression against the Lebanese as basically a continuation of the Gaza genocide. The world watched idly as Israel flattened and demolished Gaza and murdered over 43,000 Palestinians. The same is happening now in Lebanon. What has to happen for the collective international community to take action and stop these massacres? And also, in your opinion, where does this leave the credibility of international bodies such as the United Nations, who have failed Palestinians and are now failing the Lebanese people as well?
Right. On your first point, once the Israeli occupation entity is unable to actually hit the resistance infrastructure, they go for the civilians and they go for the people that support the resistance. But also, it is also true that they're seeking to cause sedition between the different sects and people in Lebanon. So, for example, we see that there's a big focus on, for example, the Shias, or this kind of conspiracy. The aim over here is to make the cost of war too much for the civilians to bear, to turn them against the resistance, and also to turn different sects in Lebanon against others. The UN will not take any action unless the Israeli occupation entity is really harmed. That's when it invokes its resolutions. And whatever the UN does is ultimately based on America's approval. So Israel has to be hurt enough for the UN to move. Otherwise, if Israel is doing well on the ground, no one will bat an eyelid for the people of the region and their rights and their struggles. So it's actually, in reality, it is the steadfastness of the resistance that ends up imposing the conditions. The solution will never come from the UN. The solution will come due to the resistance inflicting a much harm on the ground, such that the Israeli occupation entity is failing and unable to achieve its goals, that will force America, which is Israel's guarantor, to kind of end this war. We have to understand that Israel doesn't understand political talks and decisions. Nothing but force works on them. Nothing even moves the UN resolutions except the resistance. And we know that those resolutions are invoked by the West to save Israel at its time of weakness. We also know right now that it's the US that has given Israel the free hand to act as they please, you know, setting the stage for a quote-unquote new Middle East by the end of this year. We all saw that speech by Netanyahu last month in his drunken high. This idea that if Israel is successful, you know, it stands to gain significant rewards, potentially expanding to include all of Palestine, parts of Lebanon, and beyond. So that's exactly the make or break moment right now for the Israeli occupation entity as far as America's concerned. Please prove yourself. For a whole year in Gaza, you've not managed to achieve a single military strategic objective. Now we've given you the free hand to operate in Lebanon to see what you're capable of. If you fail to defeat the resistance in Lebanon, this could jeopardize the Israeli occupation entity's whole current trajectory. And so we see America, on the one hand, redefining the functional role of the Israeli occupation entity. The only thing that will curb any of this is the steadfastness of the resistance that inflicts enough harm on Israel that forces America to think in terms of strategic interests.
Professor Nim, according to data by the Committee to Protect Journalists, the Israeli war on Gaza has killed more journalists over the past year than any other conflict over the past 30 years. We are seeing the same trend in Lebanon as well. And it's not just journalists. Medical workers claim Israel is targeting them directly. UN peacekeepers said they were forced to withdraw from an observation post in southwest Lebanon after being fired on by Israeli forces. Why does Israel target journalists, medics, and even UN peacekeepers?
Well, it's quite clear that, you know, the how the Israelis are really reacting. And it's about time for the whole world to understand that these guys in Israel, this fascist government and their army, which they claim it's the most ethical army in the world, to see how ethical are they, you know, in complying with the international law, and they don't care at all. We are talking about more than 180 journalists already being killed by the Israeli Air Force and the Israeli troops, whether it's in Gaza, Strip, or in Lebanon as well. And they are continuing with that, targeting the journalists, and because they don't want the truth to be said. They know that the images which all the media give out, and as well as the social media, had harmed them a lot in around the world. And everyone now is seeing their crimes and their genocidal war against the people and against, you know, even the unarmed people, and especially the women and children. And the same they are doing with the medical teams. When they are attacking, you know, hospitals, even now they are moving all that also to Lebanon. So after they, no one protested in what happened in Gaza, they are now trying to do it in Lebanon now. In Gaza, they destroyed the hospitals. Just, you know, last week they arrested all the medical team in the hospital in the north of Gaza after they fire on it and destroy everything. They destroy even the ambulances, and they also targeting the all kind of aid workers. And we are talking about international organizations, and we are talking about people who are, by the international law, supposed to be protected. Yet the Israelis, they don't care. And this is a clear message to the international community that I'm defying everything, and I don't care. Do whatever you want, you know, to the extent that they outlawed the United Nations UNRWA. Which is serving more than 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now they outlaw it. And this is, you know, a challenge not only to the United Nations, it's a challenge to the whole international community. And yet this international community is not doing yet anything really significant to stop Israel from committing all these atrocities.
Right. Ms. Sobeiti, the most perplexing and I think appalling part of the targeting of journalists, medics, UN peacekeepers at this point is that there's been absolutely no accountability for the Israeli crimes that are being committed. So talk to us about that, please. And if there is no accountability, then it's just going to keep happening again and again.
Right. Change will not happen except with the formation of a new world order. As long as the world is being run by America at its helm, we know that Israel is simply the American project for the region. It's not this separate foreign entity. Then in that case, nothing will change. We have to understand that this is a struggle, and the struggle will not end until the Israeli occupation entity ends. Israel is a planted entity. The whole area refuses it. You know, we've seen the Oslo Accords that they tried to passed 30 years ago that completely failed. Why? Because the people in the nations of the region, even those normalizing governments like Egypt and Jordan, completely reject the occupation entity. It's built on the blood of the ethnically cleansed Palestinian people. As long as you have oppressed people calling for their rights, the struggle won't end, and in fact the struggle will be victorious for the oppressed, you know, because what happens if the oppressed decide to organize themselves and have arms, as we're seeing today? You know, if we compare the reality that's unfolding to 20 years ago, you know, you currently have 7 active fronts, you know, as Netanyahu and the Israeli administration puts it. They're even talking about this 8th front, you know. Israel is talking about the need to introduce a brigade to basically focus its efforts on Jordan, because Jordan is becoming a threatening front to them, because, you know, authorities are finding weapon depots, for example. And there's this kind of extra bridge from Jordan, which is a big threat because it's connected to Syria and Iraq. And we know that the Jordanian population is quite active and is rejecting the genocide and the occupation entity. And even if you look in 2006, for example, you see that the resistance in Lebanon was alone when it fought the July War. You see in 2021, in the Al-Quds sword battle, you know, there wasn't this unity of the fronts that we're seeing today. You know, Israel dealt with each part of the resistance access fronts separately. So today we're in a different era, you can say. We're ultimately witnessing the era of liberation. And that is, as the war continues, the resistance axis is developing and becoming even stronger. And so the development of war is the development of the resistance, and the Israeli occupation entity is drowning more and more. So there will never be accountability from America, except for the failures of Israel to actually defeat the resistance axis. That is where America will hold Israel accountable. We won't see this during war, but we'll see this post-war. Post-war, America will reprimand Israel for being a failing entity and unable to carry out the functional role for which America is supporting and sustaining Israel, and that is to strike any part of the region that falls against the American trajectory. Israel has proven that ultimately it is a failing entity, and politics runs on power and ability, and the weak has no place in the world of politics.
Professor Nim, how do you view the U.S.'s duplicitous stance regarding the Gaza genocide and Israel's ongoing regional crimes? Washington claims it's pushing for a ceasefire. It claims it doesn't want a broader regional war, but at the same time it provides Israel with all the tools, the arsenal, the equipment necessary. And of course, let's not forget the all-out political support and the billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money to continue to kill innocent women and children. And it's not just in Gaza anymore.
Well, yes, we said that many times, that the Americans are really involved in this war and are partners to the Israelis in this war and genocidal war against the Palestinians in Gaza. They are the only country who can stop Israel from doing anything, and yet they fail to stop or to make them agree to a ceasefire. It was the American, you know, initiatives many times, and Israel agreed to it, and then they changed their mind. Because by the end of the day, this administration also is very weak, and Netanyahu noticed that, and he don't care about them, and he's waiting for the elections, which is the American elections, which is coming in a few days, and he hoped that his friend Trump will be the next president, who promised him that he will let him do whatever he wants without any kind of pressure by the Americans. But so far, this Biden's administration, they helped Israel in every sense, in all the time, not only money and weapon and artillery and everything, and then to add to it also diplomatically by, you know, blocking any kind of resolution in the United Nations in order to stop or cease fire. So I think that the Americans are totally involved in this war, and they do exactly what the Israeli wanted. No, not just that, but also they start to justify the Israeli conditions and justify the Israeli atrocities. And sometimes they say, this is a little bit too much about, you know, the civilians, but at the same time they don't do nothing, you know, to stop Israel from doing that. How many times the American told the Israeli, don't go to Rafah, don't go to Rafah, and they did, and they committed all the crimes there. And the Israeli, they don't care even about the Americans, and they do whatever they want, and they know that whatever happened, America won't stop helping them and supporting them, because deeply, in as a deep state in America and Israel, the relationship is a strategic one, and they are not going to stop, you know, helping the Israelis anyway, regardless of sometimes some problems between an administration and a government in Israel. But the relationship between the two countries is totally a strategic one.
And a final question for Ms. Sawaiti, very briefly, if you may, because we're short of time for tonight's show. Many people view the inaction of some Arab regimes in the face of the ongoing genocidal war on Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the continued massacre of the Palestinians and now the Lebanese as well. Do you see it in that light as well?
Yes, the Arabs are not just turning a blind eye. They are a part of the conspiracy against this free movement, against the resistance axis. You know, we're talking about these countries that are opening their borders to the Israeli occupation entity, that are intercepting the resistance missiles and drones. And likewise, when countries from the resistance axis are targeted, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, they completely open their borders and allow the occupation entity to strike. So they are effectively a part and parcel of Israel's plan. And so it's not just a case of them being silent. And we know that if the Arab regimes, if they actually played a big role, they would have been able to effect real change in terms of boycott and besiegement. But they are giving the Israeli occupation entity effectively what it wants.
All right. Thanks a lot to Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, for joining us from Ramallah. And thanks, Status and Political Analyst Batul Sawaiti, joining us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.